Welcome to this presentation of the National Association of Record Industry Professionals. NARIP is your record industry knowledge network.
My name is Tess Taylor. I'm the president of the National Association of Record Industry Professionals. Happy to be here in New York from our Los Angeles chapter today. I'm very pleased to welcome you to this evening's presentation of The Art of the Music Deal, What Happens Before You Sign on the Dotted Line. This evening, we will be negotiating a 360 recording deal, and I can't wait to get to it. So first, a quick word about NARIP. For those of you who are here for the first time this evening, we promote career advancement, education, and goodwill among record executives. Now in our 11th year, NARIP is the leading record industry organization for career development, education, and access in this business. We are based in Los Angeles. We have chapters here in New York, San Francisco, Phoenix, Las Vegas, and London, as of 2 weeks ago in Houston, and we are launching 3 more chapters this year. We also have a mentor network, a vibrant job bank, and search services for our members. We have an online store where you can purchase audio recordings from past NARIP programs like these. In today's world, managing one's career has become a necessity and not an option. We help our members to manage their careers and identify opportunities for themselves and their companies. We achieve this through events like these, enabling access and leadership. We invite you to join NARIP and at future events. We invite you to sign up on our mailing list if you're not already on it. Upcoming NARIP events are on the last page of your handouts, also always on our website. And if you have any questions, you can see our NARIP brochures and ask any one of our very excellent board members. I want in particular to thank Jen London, if you would raise your hand, one of our NARIP New York board members. Works at Sony Distribution by day and does a great deal of narrowing by night. She's also one of the producers of our artist showcases, which you may be hearing more about. I'm also very grateful to Brandon Haas, one of our NARIP New York board members, and Susan Tigney. Where did she go? Susan in the very back. So if you have any questions, you can ask me or any one of these wonderful people. We have some luminaries with us today. I'd like to present them for your recognition. We have Eric DeFontenay sneaking out the door, who's one of the premier artist development specialists.
That's not very common.
No, it's not. I'm glad I caught you when you left. Very delighted to have Alan Friedman here today. Alan, will you raise your hand? Who's a premier, runs a premier accountancy, actually, that specializes in the music business. And I met him at NAMM about a year and a half ago, and he and his cohorts are in a band called Prince. That's P-R-I-N-T-Z, which is comprised of a bunch of music publishers and folks who work on the business end of the business, which is really kind of fun. Great band too, by the way. We have Martin Pisani. Martin, would you raise your hand? Martin has a great deal of experience in the advertising branded music world, which is becoming increasingly valuable in the industry we are in today. And we have the young Corey Roberts from Universal. Where is he? Yes, raise your hand. Very good. So I just want to point out a few people. We've got lots of independent label folks here today, some independent artists and artist managers. And I want to wish a very happy birthday to one of our wonderful members, Keith Chiang, here.
Thank you.
Okay, so. Very special thanks to our NARIP New York board members, to Michael Lane back there. Thank you very much, Michael. To Ryan and Richard Miranda here from Fordham University for making our events possible. We will open the program tonight with me moderating for about an hour and change. Thereafter, we'll take a short break, come back, close the deal, and have time for audience questions. We are recording the event tonight, so those of you who have questions will be asked to come forward. We have a small recording device here at the front of the room. If at any time you have trouble hearing us, just yell. I think I project pretty well. I know Dina does. Lisa, I'm counting on you. And Jim, I think you do pretty well. Right. Okay, good. So after the program tonight, we invite your input regarding our panel and future programming you'd like to see, topics, etc. We also invite you to share your expertise on any particular topics that you think might be of interest to our members, so just let us know. So here we go. I'm very glad to have these three experts with us tonight who will share with us their experience on how 360 deals are done and monetized and what is best for both the label and artist. All three of them have enjoyed distinguished careers in this business, and I invite you to review their profiles, which are included in your handouts. You're free to send cash or gift at any time, including me. My profile is also in your handout. And I ask you to please join me in welcoming Jim Cooperman, Dina LaPolt, and Lisa Van Zyl. So 360 deals have become, I think, the most controversial deals in the industry because they keep changing so rapidly and no one quite knows what's what. That's why we're here today. Until very recently, a number one record sold between 600 and a million units. Today, 100,000 or less can very easily become number one. A few years ago, we were shipping over 14 million records annually. Today, this number is much closer to 10 million. We've seen a huge erosion in sales. Digital sales are starting to flatten. Streaming is promising, but not yet too significant. iTunes has surpassed Walmart digital sales, but every 8 weeks, illegal site file trading surpasses the 5 billion sales of iTunes since its inception. Record companies complain that they can't make money selling records, but the label is still the engine driving the train and building artists' careers. So where does that leave us? Are 360 deals a land grab, or are they a fair adjustment to the reality of the marketplace that record companies do in fact develop careers? That's what we're going to look at tonight. So I would love sort of an overview from each of you, if you don't mind, of your position and perspective on how 360 deals have changed in the last 1 to 2 years. How far along are we? Why don't you take that, Jim?
Sure. First of all, I don't like the term 360.
Okay.
It's an obnoxious term. I like to think of it as it's really a revenue sharing arrangement.
Okay.
You just threw out some very interesting facts, and if you look at it, I was just looking at this earlier today. In the record industry, there were 105,000 albums released last year, 2008. Of that, only I believe 6,000 sold 1,000 copies or more.
In 2008.
Yeah.
Okay.
And moreover. Only about 250 of the 105,000 actually sold 100,000 units or more, according to SoundScan. So what you can see is there's an abundance of product and very few that is connecting with the consumer. As a result, it's become virtually impossible for a record company to survive just selling music. The revenue isn't there. Like you said, we've gone to an individual download market. For those of you who are familiar with the economics, a record company will net at the end of the day about 50-60 cents after you, iTunes takes its piece, and perhaps a distributor if you're a small indie, and then you have the publishers getting their 9 cents. And from that, you have to maintain the business that you build based on an album sale basis where your wholesale price is about $10. So you have to sell a lot more 50-60 cent units than $10 item to make up that difference, and yet your whole infrastructure is built around selling albums. So what have the record companies done? They've realized that they have to get into these other revenue streams. So what we do is when we sign an artist, and we've been doing this now, my company, for over 5 years, we always secure publishing, merchandise, and touring. On the publishing and on the merch, we are active publishers and we're an active merch company, and we have people who are delegated to do and designated to work just on those revenue streams. And if they're real businesses. On the touring, currently we don't have the infrastructure to really oversee touring. We don't want to go through the licensing process that you need to in certain states in the U.S. to be able to be an agent and to secure employment. So what we do is we take more of a passive participation in the revenue generated by touring. That said, as a record company, you are always very active in this scheduling of tours and the arranging of tours. You're working with the agents, you're working with the managers, because you know how important those tours are to help you accomplish what you're trying to accomplish as a record company. So from my perspective, it's not a land grab. It's very much necessary for the record companies to stay in business. And by the way, because of 105,000 albums that are shipped now annually, or released annually, labels are more important than ever. You probably, if you've done any reading about the music business, you hear about DIY and the labels are no longer needed and artists can do it themselves. I beg to differ. I've yet to really see it happen. First, you need the record company to serve as a filter, because 105,000 albums, our market cannot sustain that. Secondly, you need a marketing engine. You need someone to brand the band. You need someone out there working radio if it's a radio-related track. You need someone working the video outlets. You need someone doing the grassroots marketing. You need someone liaising with the online and mobile companies, the streaming companies, the downloaders. If you don't have that, I guarantee you, you're not going to get very far. The online do-it-yourself model is not mature enough yet to sustain an artist, from my perspective.
I'm going to save you for last, Dina, because you're not very opinionated. And Lisa, if you could respond to that, what you've seen change in the last 1 to 2 years?
From the management perspective, I would say that one of the biggest things that's changed is that, you know, with these 360 deals, all rights deals, is that, you know, the management companies really take an active role in the touring side and the marketing side. You know, our company, we're primarily a marketing company, so we're marketing just like the record companies were. We have a publicity department, we have a radio department, we've got new media departments and strategic marketing, where we're almost acting as the record label, although we're managers. So we can utilize all of our departments and work with the labels, and we can use our own resources for our artists, so we don't really need these big 360 deals. We can, you know, work more on margin, get smaller advances, so our artists are more profitable, and we can do all of the marketing in-house. And we find that working with the majors, it's very difficult for them to focus on our artists, because there are so many artists out there, and because they're more driven towards maybe the top tier artists. So we'll go and, you know, we'll market ourselves and work with them in order to build their career and brand the artist.
Now, 10th Street, the management company for which you work, run by Alan Kovac, formerly Left Bank, and just recently, within the last couple of years, you guys opened up a record company, which is called 117 Entertainment.
Yes.
When did that occur?
117 Music was formed in late 2005.
Okay.
And we started that primarily because one of our artists, Buck Cherry, we were trying to get them a record deal, and we pitched them all across the world, to all the majors, to small independent labels, and really it was very difficult to get them a deal. People thought of them as a has-been band. They had a big hit in 1999, they sold a couple million records, no one wants to hear them anymore, they're a LA-based, you know, glam rock band. So Alan said, you know what, I've run a record company before. My management company is set up like a record company. So I can do this on my own. So we started 117 Music, and we got a distribution deal with ADA. We released the record. We had a great first week. We sold about 27,000 records the first week. And as of last week, we've sold 1.4 million on that first week. So it was a great success, and that launched our label. And since then, you know, we've done a deal with various artists in the hard rock genre.
Well, I noticed one thing before we move over to Dina. In your bio, you refer to the artists on the 117 Music Group as content creation partners as opposed to artists.
Yes.
Which I think is kind of an interesting way to look at it. So,
I think, you know, the future is content. It's not necessarily managing a band and just guiding their career. It's about content, and who owns that content is where the future is going to be. And in the past, you know, record labels own the content, but that doesn't need to be the case. It can be a management company, it can be an artist themselves, as long as they have the knowledge and the way to market that content. I think it can provide, you know, very successful careers going forward.
Very good. Now, Dina, you were just telling me on this topic of how deals have changed, that very recently you had to start bringing in artist managers to be part of this 360 deal negotiation, which is a recent development. It wasn't like that before because of what, liability or?
Well, let me just tell you this. Okay, the 360 deal has many, many different permeations of what it is. And Jim, forgive me, but it is a 360 deal. You know, you have your hands in everybody's pocket. And that's, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And you have 360 deals that are set up kind of like an employment agreement arrangement where you have like the pussycat dolls that are actually working, you know, have employment agreements with the company and are on salary and the whole thing and the company owns everything. Or you have 360 deals where there's the Live Nation deals that happened a couple of years ago where they would give, you know, heritage artists like Madonna or U2, you know, $100 million and they would control everything and then, you know, they would really own the brand for a certain period of time before the brand reverted back to the artist. And then you have these emerging artist deals where everybody's doing them. So you have this 360 deal where in the beginning, when I did this deal with Jim, like probably 2005. All right, so 2005, you know, he gives me this deal memo, and I said, this is horrid, because it was everything. It was touring and co-publishing and merchandising and records, and, you know, it was horrible, oh my God, oh my God. And now, all the record companies are doing it, and they've taken it to a very horrific level. So in other words, like Jim's company's deals are actually, believe it or not, very favorable to the artists right now, where in 2005, they were the only company, they were really, you know, pioneers in this 360 model. And now you have every company doing it, all the major labels are doing it, and, you know, the thing is, usually I would negotiate the record deal, you know, based upon industry customs and the deal points or whatever, and I'd confer with the manager on certain things, of course, confer with the business manager on tax issues and stuff like that, but pretty much, you know, the music lawyer was a one-woman show, and I would do the negotiation when the deal was signed, explain to the artist when the deal's done and the whole thing, and it's not like that anymore, because there's so much exposure, and there's so much liability for what's happening. I mean, now, you know, you're spending enormous amounts of time, you know, negotiating with labels on touring, where they want a percentage of the gross touring, and labels don't understand touring. And touring is an entirely different beast of a name that, you know, you really, you know, it's very complicated. And, you know, to explain touring, how touring works to a music label lawyer is like speaking Russian, you know, when the primary language is English. I mean, they don't understand it. So, you know, and then also like the merchandising rights that they're requesting for the artist, from the artist, and the co-publishing rights, you end up having to bring in other artist professionals like the manager and the business manager and actively confer with them on certain provisions of the agreement, because you just don't have the expertise as the lawyer to negotiate those provisions in a vacuum anymore. So if, for instance, if Universal Motown is taking 10% of the artist gross touring, there's a huge ramification with that, especially like, you know, with a concert promoter like Live Nation or AEG. You know, the way artists get paid, they might get paid, you know, say let's pretend $10,000 a show, gross. But out of that $10,000 a show comes travel, hotels, the tour manager, whoever, roadie, what they have, you know, the tour bus or a van. Most of the time, you know, an artist is in a van or pulling a U-Haul. You know, they got to eat on that money. All the commissions come out of there. You know, the lawyer's commission, the manager's commission, the business manager's commission, the agent's commission.
Well, so you have a 360. I can't.
Right. Well, the point is that, yeah, all these, but let me tell you something. Jim doesn't get the phone calls at 3 o'clock in the morning from my artist in Germany saying, my show's been canceled in Greece. What the hell do I do? You know, I get those calls, and then I call Lisa, and we have to deal with that. Jim's home sleeping in his bed, and everything's all nice. You know, and I come in all haggard, and he's all getting 10% of gross, and I've just been through hell and back. You know, get a good night's sleep, Jim, right?
Well, our deals are not on gross.
That, you know what I'm saying.
Some of my competitors' deals must be on gross.
Terrible.
The good news is we've been doing it long enough that we realize taking off gross is really grossly unfair, part of the fun. Because there are certain costs that have to come off the top. And the notion, from our perspective, is not to put the artist in a position where they're cutting me a check and they're going into hock. because if I have an upset, if an artist that's in hot because of they're paying me, they're just going to come to me on one of the other revenue streams and say, give me an advance because I need to pay you over here, which is ridiculous.
So let me just understand. So Wyndup is one of the few or one of the only labels that pays, that does not do these deals on gross, does them on net? Is that unusual?
I have no idea what my competition does.
Okay. Yes.
I don't want to. It's an antitrust violation.
Okay.
What I can tell you is we take it on what we call an adjusted gross.
Okay.
And it depends on the deal. Certain things can come off the top. Because at the end of the day, we really look at these deals, and someone said it today in another conference, and they said, it's not a 360 deal, it's a 365 deal, because you're working 365 days, you're working your ass off for these bands. So I actually like that a little bit. I think it's more accurate. And that said, we will allow the artists to pay certain costs off the top, their real costs, because we recognize that's reality. And I would venture to guess that some of my competitors who have not been in the touring game very long, much like I was 4 or 5 years ago, I didn't know either, can't believe it. And we fight for to be paid on gross and realized it was unfair, and it really didn't make sense. So we backed off that position, and my guess is my competitors will, when they become a little bit more familiar with the touring market.
Can we get one of your form agreements?
No.
Rats. Okay. I like that. And these are valuable things, by the way. I mean, I collect these things like some people collect.
Gina has one of mine.
Really? Okay.
Very high grade.
Okay. It's good. I mean, I love to see how the different companies, you know, break the things down and the very Machiavellian nature of these agreements in the first place, where, you know, you get a lot in paragraph one and it kind of gets eroded in paragraph 35A. But anyway, let's start in on this mock negotiation. So these are lots of fun. We're going to play roles this evening that are very close to what these three would actually do in reality. So, and we have a wonderful handout here. I want to give extra thanks to Dina LaPolt, who teaches a class at UCL Extension, has prepared a very fantastic handout for us, which we're going to go over various parts of it later. But I want to get straight to the mock negotiation itself. So if you would turn to page 6, we've outlined the deal points of this particular recording agreement. I like the fact, Dina, that you've named this band Delicious. Perhaps a tip of the cap to my fictitious character, Trixie Delicious. Okay, so this three-piece girl group, Delicious, being represented by Dina as their lawyer, has received an offer from independent label Slick Ride Records, which has some prominent rap and R&B artists. Although Delicious is a pop dance act, the owner of Slick Rick Records loves the group and believes in them. Their first album is done. One of their songs, Britney Gets Her Ass Kicked, very nice, is being played on prominent rhythm and pop stations in some large markets, including New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Dallas. Other offers from labels are imminent. Because Slick Rick Records has become successful over the past 10 years, they have a distribution arrangement with Atlantic for some of their artists, and they also have a label deal with Universal. At the time of the offer, Slick Rick does not know whether they will put the group through their Atlantic deal or their Universal deal, i.e. a distribution deal or a label deal. And three principals up here have worked out this fact pattern together, so they're all familiar with it. And let's just begin. So, Jim, is this sort of in line with what you would normally offer? That's assuming that you're the lawyer negotiating on behalf of Slick Rick Records.
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
How would it be done, you're saying? Are you asking how the protocol?
Yeah, what would happen? You talk to the label owner, Slick Rick, and he give you deal points on a napkin.
Well, he'd say, you know, I really want to sign this band.
Okay.
Talking through and say, okay, what are we prepared to spend? What do we think the record's going to cost? In this case, the record is primarily done. We'd probably want to do a little reconnaissance and find out how much they paid to do it on their own dime. What do we see as the future? What do we see as, you know, sales? Does this act have a touring future? Is it really just a radio hit? What's the merch like? Do some research on the band, the manager, the lawyer, and would then send a proposal to Dina.
Okay. So then your proposal from the label would come to the band's lawyer.
Or the manager.
And
sometimes the lawyer doesn't get involved until after the manager has built up a rapport with the label executives. And it could happen that I would send it to the manager. It's really just how the relationship unfolds.
All right. So this is basically the outline of the deal memo, recording, merch, publishing, and touring that you've sent to Dina. And Dina, you get this and you say, okay, very interesting. What's your next move? You call Lisa?
Well, normally Jim would call me first, okay? Because we have a relationship. So he would call me, right?
Yes.
And you go through something.
All right. I might discuss a few of the key issues before I send it.
Pretend. See, just like it's normal.
Just have it, baby.
Hi, Jim. Are you hitting me up for some charity again?
So we walked, I mean, if you want to do it,
yeah,
we can do it through the side, say, all right, look, we're looking to sign your act, Delicious, A&R loves it, management loves it. We see a long-term future with this artist, I want to sign it to a long-term deal. I want to give them enough money that they can survive while they're making the record, while they're on the road, that their bills are paid. It's really important to us as a label to know that our artists have their nuts covered, so to speak, and that they don't have to worry about, is the rent going to be paid while they're on the road? You know, is there food on the table for their kids, for their siblings, whatever it is? So I'm going to make you an offer that's going to put enough money in their pocket, but at the same time, keep them hungry, because it's really important that the artists stay motivated. Because of, you know, we're in this 360, 365 world now, and the proposal that I'm going to send you is going to be for recording, publishing, merch, and touring, and everything that's attended to that, sponsorships, endorsements.
God, you're killing me, Jim.
But the way we structure our deals is we do separate agreements for each. I know some of my competitors may throw everything into one pot. And candidly, I know that you can take this act and shop a separate publishing deal and a separate merch deal, and I know that you and the manager of the artist may have some issues with giving up some of the touring revenue. But as you well know, things are different than the last time you and I did a deal together. It's a very different world.
So let me ask you, are all the income streams uncross-collateralized?
Correct. Each deal will stand on its own, because I know you're going to turn around and say to me, well, if I do my own arm's length publishing deal, I wouldn't get strapped with any of this and it wouldn't be cross-collateralized with my record deal. And I recognize that, and I as a notion of deal making. And so in consideration for the full pathway of rights that we're looking for, I am prepared to allow each of the rights to stand alone and not be cross-collateralized with one another.
And Dina, I'm not going to assume that everyone knows what cross-collateralization is, although I assume that 90% of you do. But can you tell us exactly what that is and why it's important that they remain uncrossed and not cross-collateralized?
Well, typically, you know, the label will spend a pot of money and they will typically not want to let the artist, they don't want to pay the artist any income streams until they get paid back their initial investment. So most of their money is going to be spent on the record. So they don't, Jim's, you know, for instance, doesn't want to spend $100,000 making the record, you know, $200,000 marketing it, $500,000 in promotion, and now we're on recouped, you know. And then they're paying us an income stream for merchandising when we're unrecouped on records. So he's automatically saying that the income streams are not cross-collateralized. So despite the fact that we will be unrecouped for records, we'll still make money in the other income streams that he's saying that he wants to sign up with for us.
Which is a key factor in a deal like this.
So at this point, what I would say to Jim is, well, look, you know, let me hear what you have to say. I said, I'm going to talk to the manager. She just got them on tour with the Pussycat Dolls. And I have a publishing company, a hot shot publishing company, Bicycle Music, who used to just publish the Neil Diamond catalog, but they got an influx of money from a private investor, and they're now signing new acts. And one of the girls in Delicious, you know, writes under a country music pseudonym, and she's actually written, you know, a hit for Taylor Swift, and I really am very adamant that we want to keep publishing and have a separate relationship with a separate company. But why don't you tell me what you're thinking, Jim, as far as what you're offering?
Not to sound draconian, the reality is in this economy, with the way music sales are diminishing, we will not be able to conclude a deal on the record side, absent these other revenue streams. Now that said, as I mentioned, I want to do deals with you that are fair, so you can go back to your client and say, we really wouldn't have received anything better having gone to a third party. Because at the end of the day, it's important that the artists feel that this is their home and that we have a true partnership. I am going to offer you a publishing deal that is competitive with any other publishing deal that you can secure in the marketplace. I'm confident of that. And I also know that based on our relationships, we're going to be able to exploit the compositions as readily as any of our competitors. Moreover, you know, some lawyers will look at it and say, you know, I love the notion that everything's under one roof. In fact, a very talented lawyer once said that to me once.
Who was that? Don't you throw back my stuff.
The fact that our record company and our publishing company are working, and our merch company for that matter, are working arm in arm so that when, you know, it's in sync, can we take a step back?
Of course.
Record companies and publishers now look at licensing income, master use licensing, and sync licensing as a very important part of their business. Certain artists have been broken just on a master use license, not from anything at radio or TV or, you know, MTV. But it's very frustrating for the music supervisors and the film and TV production companies to clear, because what they have to do is they have to go to the record company, and then they have to go to the publisher, and each of them have to go to the artist or their writer. And so what we offer by having the publishing and the recording under one roof is one-stop shopping. And I can tell you firsthand that I have music supervisors and film producers who love that fact. We can do everything but pre-clear, and so when they come to us, they know it is one, we make one phone call, and it's clear. And we know the value of master use licensing, and we know that if we work with them on this one use, they will help us with this band and with other masters that this band creates down the road.
Well, the problem with that is you actually sold our publisher. So now we're not under one roof. So let me tell you this. Let's go back to this backpacking. So, okay, that sounds really good, Jim. But, yeah, now I have to deal with some idiot. You know, that sounds really good, Jim, but unfortunately, you know, there's songwriters in the group. I mean, this isn't just like three, you know, girls with some cute asses. I mean, they actually like write some songs, and they have some publishers that really are into them, and, you know, that's going to be hard. And I know your company's policy is four agreements or no agreements, essentially. So it's like we have to either, if we're going to sign up with you, it's not two out of four agreements or three out of four, it's four out of four agreements. Or it's a deal breaker.
Right.
So, you know, I have to talk to the manager about that, you know, because, so let me get back to you, okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Is that true, Jim? It's four or none? Okay.
Which is very difficult for this negotiation, because that's really how this company does it.
Okay.
So the other companies, and I got to tell you something, stepping back here for a minute. The first offer you get, I'm going to tell you this right now, if one of my clients gets an offer and there's nobody else that's after them, you're pretty much screwed in the woods, okay? You have to negotiate within these parameters that they're offering, like Jim, four out of four, he wants to sign up four sets of rights, records, publishing, merchandising, touring. And if he doesn't get those all four rights, he doesn't want to be bothered, there's no deal. So it's a deal killer. There's no negotiation is what he's saying. This is the case for his company, although I've never been in a situation with Jim where they wanted a group so bad that another company came in with a competing offer, okay? Because our deal wasn't like that. You guys came and signed that deal, and there was really no one else.
We've done deals in the past where we did forego a certain set of rights, and we definitely resent or regret the fact that we did that, and in retrospect, wish we hadn't done that. Because the reality is, in this economy, the industry the way it is, I have much less incentive to work, put in the effort and commit the resources to a band where I don't have all those revenue streams. Now, there are certain superstar acts, you know, they are the exception to the rule. But if I have two bands, and I have the same record deal with both of them, but on another one I have merch and I have touring, someone comes to me and says, I have a tour up, you know, some agent comes to us and says, or a promoter comes to us and says, we have this great tour. Well, which band? I'm like, and let's assume, all things being equal, you know, the bands are on equal footing. Which band am I going to promote?
The one with the merch deal.
Of course.
Well, here's the thing. Most of the promoters don't call the record company to offer tours, okay? So let's be real, okay? They're going to call the manager. They're not going to call the record company, hey, I've got this great tour up with Britney, Jimmy Iovine, who do you got to put on the tour?
Well,
that's not how it's going to work.
The next goal is, and it's a $50,000 buy-on, and who's going to buy on?
Well, the call still comes to the manager.
That check?
Because the managers are the ones that are really run the artist enterprise, and they're kind of in charge, and they have all, you know,
I would say this. There are some managers who are terrific and bring a lot to the table and are extremely helpful and work in concert with the record company to help break the artist. There are other managers who just happen to have been in the right place at the right time, and either are a friendager or a momager, or, you know, call it what you will.
and that's why we bring very little to the table,
are forced to deal with
them. Yeah, but I don't like that either, okay? I mean, my rule of thumb is if I'm more powerful than the manager, it's fucked up, okay? That's, sorry, Tess.
You're 40 minutes.
We got so far. I lasted 40 minutes. Seriously, I mean, you know, that's a hardship. So, you know, I mean, I'm not ever one to oust somebody. I mean, I don't get into those I mean, that's actionable, like trying to interfere in somebody's professional relationship. But for real, I mean, managers have a real job, and it's like if I've got somebody's mom trying to manage my client, it's a recipe for disaster. Not only do I have to negotiate the deal points and the deals, but I'm also having to educate the manager on how the business works, and that's a hardship.
But you know that's the case. I mean, we don't pick the manager. We have no say in the manager. The band picks their manager, and sometimes they'll do the right thing, and sometimes they won't. And we may try to persuade them to do certain things, but at the end of the day, we're not going to interfere with that relationship.
So getting back to this, apparently your band has a publishing deal in the works or done?
Well, I got to call the manager, Lisa.
Okay.
Because what my point is, you know, we if my group wants to go to this company, then I've got to get another offer on the table so I can really create some value and then I can get rid of some of these rights. So, but he's trying to take it. Lisa.
Hey, Dina.
I just got a call from Jim Cooperman at Windup. Do you know that they want to sign Delicious?
I have heard that. I've saw the deal.
You know, I mean, what do you think?
I've got a real issue with all the copyright rights. You know, as managers, we've worked with this band now for 3 years. We've developed them. We've built them to a great touring base. I feel that that is our niche with this band, that we've been able to build them from a small little club band playing for 50 people. We've got them playing in small clubs, 1,000-seaters, and with all the radio play we've been able to get them in major markets, they're really growing.
Yeah, and I just think, like, if you have to do this, you know, you've created a lot of value with these girls, and if we're going to, you know, do this 360 deal with Windup, I mean, you're going to give them the seat at the table here. They're going to be involved in everything we're doing, and, you know, you've done a lot for the girls just before we've even gotten a record deal.
Right. I mean, we're really moving at radio. We've been able to use our resources in-house to get them all the spins at radio, and the tour's doing well. Merchandise is selling through the roof. You know, we're working with great designers. We're have great t-shirts. We're really selling online as well as at the venue. And, you know, the merchandise and touring goes hand in hand.
I don't know what fact pattern you're reading from, but that first record isn't out, and I defy you to find a tour and a band that's selling massive merch on first album.
Yeah, we have this, Jim.
Since their first album is
done. Yeah, but they're still on tour. They're a touring group. We're building them on tour.
And they have radio. I have to tell you, absolutely.
They have radio.
Jim,
this is not.
Why are you even talking to me? Dance. If you have radio play, you're selling out venues, you're selling merchandise.
Because you're trying to sign them. Your A&R person loves them.
They didn't have to talk to us. There's obviously been dialogue. They want to come to a record. I just think
you can
spin this however you want. There is no way what you just described would be happening absent a record release. Absolutely. There's nothing you can say that would convince me.
I don't know, because look what they did with Gold Cherry.
Cherry was a known entity. I mean, it's marvelous what you did. I'm not taking anything away. You guys did a great job. But you became the label. You did what labels do. So if you're going to do what labels do, you are the label.
Right.
Which is fine. So you're another record company.
But we want to come to you so we could use your money to do what we want and then build it.
But I shouldn't get anything for it because I'm the big bad wolf.
Right. So let's figure out how we're going to make this work. So I'm going to think about calling you back here, and maybe we figure out where we can, you know, try to make this work, because you guys
are... You can prove me wrong. I don't know of any artist who has really built a career from scratch without any label support. I just don't know of any. And Buck Cherry did not do it without label support.
Okay.
There was a label that spent a lot of money and sold a lot of records before you picked them up.
We did the bulk of it on the management side.
But they were known entity.
They could walk
into a radio station, and they had those They had the connections and they had the relationships.
No, people would shut the door and say, get out, you has-been. It's worse to have an artist that started than they were.
Certain labels would probably not sign them, but that doesn't mean the name doesn't have value in the marketplace.
Not at radio, not if you have an artist.
Heritage acts could sign all the time because you can, you know there's a certain modicum of sales you're going to have just based on ranking.
All right, well, first of all, let me tell you this. On this girl group, this group is going on tour with the Pussycat Dolls, this girl group, and they're not signed. This is a girl group, and this is happening.
And then you're going to get offers out the wazoo.
Right, and you're one of them, so that's what I'm saying. I'm calling Lisa, you're just going to get her ass in here and start calling somebody else. Because your deal stinks. You better start, because Jim Cooperman is 4 out of 4. He's not going to budge. He, you know, they were pioneers in this field. We need to get another offer in, because we're not going to move. This guy's not going to move.
The merchandise I can see working with them to help us expand. They have great retail connections internationally that they can help us with. I get that. I also, you know, going back and looking at the rights, you know, the main girl is acting. She's been doing shows, Gossip Girl. She's
right.
been on all of these
I
shows.
Forgot about that. She's
you know, she's an actress. She has an agent already that we're working with, and we've been building her acting career to coincide with her musical career, and I don't think giving them those rights.
All right, let me call him back. Let me ask him this. Let me see if we can kick out acting because What's Her Face is on Gossip Girls. And let's say we can kick out publishing because What's Her Name is writing some of those songs. And let's see if we can see if we can make this work, okay?
Okay.
But if they're going to give, you know, let me just say, I'll call you back.
Okay, before you call Jim back. Jim, did you say that your standard deals do include sponsorship and endorsements? Okay, so it's really more like 6 out of 6, or is sponsorship and endorsements considered one deal?
Well, the way we would structure it generally is that it's a tour sponsorship, it would be the touring deal, and if it's another type of sponsorship or endorsement, we'd probably put it in the merch deal.
And I would also like to say, because I have a major label background myself, and as much as I endorse the DIY way of doing things, I have to agree with Jim that it's very, very difficult, nearly impossible, for most artists to get anywhere without a decent team. And mostly that ends up being a label. And, you know, unless you can hire people on a, you know, a la carte basis to do the marketing, publicity, et cetera, for you, and be mindful of the camera gentlemen. Thank you so much. Nice to see you. All right. So, now you're calling Jim back.
Can I respond to what you just said, though?
Yes.
That's how most managers work. I mean, I get it. You know, there's usually a manager and an assistant, someone who handles the scheduling and the phone calls. But our company is not set up like that. We're set up like a record label. We have all those
But all the big managers
all
are now.
All the big managers are. They're following our lead.
19 Entertainment, Irving Azoff's company.
Yep.
I mean, all of them. They
Collected,
have promotion
everybody.
Departments. They have, you know, everything. So what I was going to say, here's the reality. Everybody's doing these 360 deals, but the way you get the best deal for your artist is you have to have competing offers.
Right.
So there has to be more than one company trying to sign the artist, because I'm going to tell you something. Most of these record labels are run by men, and men will be men, and boy, do they hate competition. So it becomes the war of the penises. I'm sorry. But it does. And someone always needs to win. So they start doing stupid things and making stupid decisions, and then I'm sneaking up in there, you know? But this is exactly what happened, so for real. So your company's a little different, I gotta say. Your company's different, Jim, because you
just came up with a new label name, but I'll share it.
Trademark. So seriously, so there's always like this war, you know, like a bidding war. You have this kind of situation, and it becomes, you know, pretty stressful, and then that's how you get some of these rights kicked out. So for me, as the artist attorney, in this climate, with this music industry right now, even what she's saying, one of the girls is on Gossip Girls, the other girl writes some country songs, even with that going on, even with Lisa getting, you know, their song charted on the rhythm stations, you know, in some of these major markets, it's still going to be hard for me to get some of these rights kicked out unless I have another offer. So that's that.
So you're calling Jim back.
Right, so I'm calling Jim back.
So you just conveyed all that for me?
Hi, Jim. Okay. Jim.
Yes.
Basically, you want to get rid of publishing because you have a girl that has we want to get rid of acting. Everything else we can work with, but I got to talk to you about touring. How do you do this on touring? Can you explain it to me? Because the manager and the agent are kind of stressed out about giving some of the tour percentage to you when there's not a lot left over for the girls.
All right, let's deal with the low-hanging fruit first.
Okay.
On the acting, because she already is acting.
Right. You could speak up just a little bit, Jim.
Sure. Because one of the girls in the band is already acting, I understand that. So she will not secure these acting opportunities because of our efforts. So therefore, I would be prepared to allow her to continue to act, provided she doesn't give, you know, a musical performance without us being involved. And that whatever she does as an actress does not directly interfere with all of her activities that she's supposed to do as part of this group and on our behalf. So, assuming you can accommodate those requests, I can carve that out of the deal.
What about for the other two girls? You know, these are girls, they're all stressed out, and
they're
wanting something better than the other girls.
Are the other two already acting?
Well, they're not successful like What's-Her-Face, who's on Gossip Girl, but they've had, you know, they both are really, you know, they're fine, they have agents.
Again, I'm not opposed to carving that out with those caveats, that they not perform as musical performers, and that they have to recognize, with all the money that I'm putting into this deal, that this has to be their first, second, and third priority. If during their downtime they get an acting opportunity presents itself, we'd like to know what it is. Maybe we can work with the music supervisor to get some of their music in the show, because that would be a great way to launch them. It would be a tie-in with the program.
Okay, well, I'll talk to Lisa.
Which is a perfect segue into why we should have the publisher. Well, because now I can do that one-stop shopping with the music supervisor of the television program in which they're acting.
Well, maybe if we, you know, like, let me ask you about the publishing. Maybe, you know, of course I had to go back to my client, the manager, but, you know, if we did publishing, maybe you can agree that you won't assign the publishing to anyone without our written permission, because it would be a shame to, like, me have to sell this concept to them and then you go and sell publishing off and I have to deal with somebody else.
I can't, working for an entrepreneur, I can't tie his hands like that. Right now he has no designs on doing anything like that. He has expressed no interest to disposing of any of his assets, but as you well know, you represent a lot of entrepreneurs. You can't tie their hands. What I would say is you've made it pretty clear that she's already written some songs for some other people, and as much as I'd like to get a publishing interest in those songs, I would be prepared to allow you any songs she's written that are not on this album and that have been previously recorded to be excluded from this deal, so that to the extent you have to abide by some pre-existing relationship that the other artist has, she won't be bound by that, so I would grandfather those out of the deal as well, but I'd like to know what those are so my A&R can do a little research on that.
Well, here's the thing with that. I mean, we're actively, you know, trying to build relationships in Nashville for her to be co-writing these songs. I mean, you know, with these other artists and some of the songwriters, so, you know, just for you to exclude the ones that she's already written, what you're essentially doing is saying that you want to come in and capitalize on our relationships that we've already built in a genre that you're not even working in. So I don't know about that. But the other thing, too, is that, you know, are you offering any kind of publishing advance?
Yeah, I'd be willing to consider a reasonable advance akin to what we've offered on the Birch deal.
So what would that be?
I'd say about $20,000 a year to each year of the term.
So that would be paid yearly? Would it be worked in an option or whatever?
No, you know, we traditionally used to do that, and we can do an aside now. I don't know how many are you familiar with how deals were typically structured. On the record and publishing side, you'd get an upfront advance, and then you'd have these funds for future albums, and there would be a minimum and a maximum based on the royalties generated by usually the prior project or an average of the two prior projects. What we've done and what a lot of companies have done is gone away from that. One of the things we found is that the artists get their first advance when you sign them, and that money is gone almost instantaneously. The manager gets a piece, the business manager, the lawyer, everyone gets their pace. Then they're paying off bills because they may have spent time in a recording studio. They already have nothing, and you're now just starting to make the record. And then they come to you and say, hey, I can't pay my rent. You know, I've got two illegitimate kids I got to pay for, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, now the money just starts pouring out of the record company. And then, you know, you create this level of resentment. You're shelling out all this cash. They still don't have a record. And so we made a conscious decision a couple of years ago to just, you know, the nice thing about working as an indie is you're not wedded to the old ways. Senior manager at my company, myself aside, I've never worked at a major record company. And they said, well, this is really broken. How do we fix this? And so what we did is we came up with this concept of monthly advances that the artist can use to make sure that their living expenses are covered so that when they are performing, are recording, writing, whatever it is that they're doing, their expenses are covered and they can do it with a clear conscience. And that's worked exceedingly well. And that's what I'm promoting in this instance.
Okay, so basically you're saying that, you know, for the publishing you're giving $20,000 a year.
Right.
For the merch you're gonna give them $20,000 a year. Right. With additional rollover advances and they hit their profit margins.
Right.
And then for records you wanna pay them $40,000 a year as well.
Yep.
Okay, so you're talking about $70,000 a year for the three girls.
What's 80, but
$80,000 a year for the three girls.
And I'm paying recording costs on top of that at $4,000 per track, so they don't have to worry about paying for the recording costs out of that. And if,
what do you mean you're paying for recording costs $4,000 in addition to the $4,000 per track?
No. That's the fund. Another thing we've done is typically the way it would work is there'd just be a lump sum. So let's say the number for argument's sake is $100,000. Guys, here's $100,000, we want a record. We don't care what you do with that money. We just know in 4 months' time we want an album delivered to us. Go have at it. That didn't work either. Because records were never made on budget and they were never made on time and they always were coming back for more money. And again, then you find yourself in this situation where before a record has even been delivered, there are tension and resentment. We really wanted to try to eliminate that. So what we said is, let's look at this realistically. What does it cost to make a record? You know, you hear about, well, you should be able to make a record for $10,000. Well, yeah, you should. The technology is there. I've yet to see it happen, at least in the genres that we deal in, be it R&B or rock and pop. I've yet to see it happen. We work with top-line producers. We work with A&R people who are also producers and writers in their own right, and they're not willing to cut corners. And so as a result, you start looking at this and you say, what is it really costing us? So I have offered in this proposal a $4,000 per track budget. That doesn't mean that if it's $3,000 that the artist keeps $1,000. It means that we will allocate up to $4,000 per track to make a record. And we think for that amount of money, you should be able to hire a producer and find a studio where you can do a state-of-the-art recording with a top-flight producer and engineer and deliver a record that we can feel good about and will have commercial viability.
I don't know what producer is going to work $4,000 a track. I mean, maybe indie producers, but like, you know, for a pop group or a dance pop group like this, you know, Lisa, you call Max Martin and ask.
Yeah. Well, what are the ranges for that kind of producer?
That kind of producer, like Max Martin, is now $50,000 to $70,000 a track.
Okay. But he's high end.
And he's not going to do, he'll do one track. He's not going to do one.
Yeah.
Track.
Andrew Frampton, what is he now, Corey? $20,000 a track?
Yeah.
$20,000 a track, right?
Okay.
More? Now he's more? Yeah. Polo the Don, he's like $40,000 a track. I mean, you know, here's the good thing. This particular group writes and produces their own stuff. I mean, that's good. I mean, so that's, you know, because I'm kind of taking, I've changed the names, but this particular group writes and produces their own stuff. So if you, here's my thing with you, Jim. If your record company, A&R guy, is fine with their sound and how they're doing, then let me talk to Lisa, because maybe that can work, because the girls, one girl produces and the other two girls write, but you being a label, if all of a sudden you're gonna wanna sprinkle it with T-Pain and, you know, Lil Wayne and whoever else you gotta throw on there because of the type of music it is, then that's not gonna work, so.
I would say this, I think we should stick with the 4,000 because we can use it as a guideline, a parameter. That said, if we need someone to come in and do a step out featured vocal and they're gonna insist on some money, I know that's in the best interest of the project. We will pay for that. It'll be an additional cost. It's not gonna serve to reduce your monthly monies because we recognize that wouldn't be fair. This gives me some comfort that if we go over, here is we hire a big name producer to produce a track like a Max Martin, or we get Chris Lord Algae in to mix the album, and he's going to charge, you know, $1,500, $2,000 a track. I'm prepared to pay that money. But it gives me comfort knowing that, other than those extraordinary expenses, that I can budget this kind of money, this $4,000 per track, for this album.
All right, let me ask Lisa. Lisa, this is what Jim said.
If you guys could speak up just a little
bit. Okay, this is what Jim said. Jim says, you know, he's going to kick in $20,000 a year for publishing. So it won't be tied to any term or, like, you know, minimum delivery requirement, which is how publishers move, you know, keep you in, you know, in their term and not move you into options. So he's willing to pay $20,000 a year for publishing, $20,000 a year for the merch rights, you know, $40,000 a year for records that they would divide up among, you know, by 12 months. And for the first album, they'll pay $4,000 a track. I mean, you know, if they love the record and they like, you know, and he says that if there's a special step out performance of someone they want on the record, like a big name, we'll deal with it when we get to it. I mean, what do you think? They said that they'd leave the girls out for acting as long as it's not musical acting, which means that I'm going to get into a three-hour discussion on the definition of musical acting, which is a true story, a la Jerry Proust. Musical acting took up 3 hours of my day trying to figure out the definition. So, and then they're willing to cut their kick out the previously written compositions that you got placed in Nashville.
Well, starting with the recording, the girls are already delivering a fully completed record. So it's 10 tracks they're giving you guys. They've spent $80,000 making this record. They took their time, they got in the studio, they spent, you know, session time.
That's what you
so
we
spent $80,000. It took them, you know, 16 months writing, recording, rehearsing. And that's what they've spent. And there was no outside producer, so there's no back-end points, there's no issue there. It's just that's what they've spent. It's gonna take them now 2 years to recoup that from this deal. So that's just one little side note.
Sure. So maybe we can get him, if I could go back, and maybe get him to reimburse the costs, $80,000, you know, plus put something else on top of it. You know, also I gotta talk to him about legal fees. You know, these agreements are gonna be a bear. I mean, four agreements, you know, this is going to be crazy. I'm going to see if he'll go back and build in some legal fees. I'm thinking, you know, maybe put in $7,500 per agreement and see if he'll agree to that above and beyond what he's paying the group, you know, so that money, you know, is separate apart, and then I don't have to commission anything and I get my work done and stay objective. But
could you touch on, just a moment, how you're paid? Because we know how the label is paid. We know how the manager is paid.
This is how we do it.
How do you
normally
do it?
Entertainment lawyers are paid 5% of gross. But let me tell you something. We do I don't know why. People say they're not signing people. It's full of shit. Because we're signing so many people, it's making my head spin. But we can't, with the way the music industry, as it is right now, getting 5% of $40,000 when I have 400 hours worth of legal work to do is not going to fly. So go hire somebody else. I'm really good at what I do. I have four lawyers at my firm. We're really good at what we do. We will fight. You can ask any one of these two that I worked with before. You know, and I'm a perfectionist. So I also don't want to be so... I don't want to ever have the devil on my shoulder where I'm fighting to get the most advance for the artist, because that's how I get paid, and I'm going to sell up your rights. You know what I mean? Like, oh yeah, I'll give you publishing, I'll give you touring, but give me a $300,000 advance. I don't ever want to have that fight, okay? I always want to stay objective. So the way it works is I know how long it's going to take us to negotiate these deals. If I'm doing a rap act on Universal, Their agreement is 100 pages. We're going to do a short form. Then we're going to do a long form, which is going to take 4 months. There's going to be five producers, maybe six or seven producers at least. I have to do all those producer agreements. Plus, there's going to be some step-out artists. They're going to throw Fergie on there and somebody else that's going to suck up my time. You know, if there's samples on there, I'm going to have to oversee the sample clearance person at the label because they don't know really what's going on there. And, you know, it just takes a lot of time. So I need to be able to have, to get paid for what I'm doing. Now, with that said, even though my hourly rate is $500 an hour currently, that's not what I'm going to get paid. So there's no way for all this work that I just described that I'm going to get paid my hourly rate, because that would be $160,000 worth of legal work. So we compromise. So what I say is, if I get a new artist and I'm signing him to a record deal, I'll say, look, everything after I sign you up, we're on 5%. But for the initial record deal and the first album, we're going to work on a flat fee. So if I'm signing them to, say, you know, a Warner Brothers or Atlantic or a major label, Universal, I'll say, we need $20,000 to negotiate your record deal, which I'll build into the record deal above and beyond what they're going to pay you. And it'll still be your advance. You're still paying it, but the difference is you don't have to write me a check right now. So I'll do that, and I'll do the negotiation of the record deal, and I'll fight like hell, and I'll be available to you to call, you know, you calling me left, right, and center, you know, all that stuff. You'll be completely a new person when I'm done with you, completely educated, up to speed, know your business. And for all the producer agreements, I'll do that as well. But after that, then we go on a 5% basis. So we work it out. Some artists will say, you know what, no. And then I say, call these other lawyers. And I actually will give them three names of people that I think are amazing, that might do it for a lesser expensive price. Not me, because I'm already compromising my fees and we're busy. So it is what it is, you know what I mean? And I think that what I've done in my career for myself speaks for itself, and I can say that. And also the other thing too is that fees are negotiable with lawyers. So a lot of clients will say, well, that seems to be a lot. You know, we talk it through, but if I sit the client down and I explain to them the process, okay, now Jim Cooperman's deals are actually really easily, drafted very good. There's not a lot of legal mumbo-jumbo craziness in there. Each form, the record form is a little bit longer, but the other forms are like 15, 20 pages, so they're great forms. So for Jim Cooperman's deals, I might say, you know, give me $3,500 an agreement, and I'll work with that. Maybe the record deal will be $5,000 or $7,000, because that's like maybe 30 pages. But so I could do all four of his agreements probably within $20,000. And depending, I'll talk to him to find out what the status is of A&R. So if the A&R person wants to bring in all these producers and all these new people to work on the record, I know I have to do all those agreements, so I'll have to get more money. But if Jim says to me, hey, we love the record, the only thing we're going to do is bring in Chris Lord Algae to mix the thing, and we have a standard form with him that you can approve, then we're good to go. My work is kind of, you know, I know what the work is. I've done this so many years, and I know exactly what the work is and how long it's going to take me and who my firm is going to do the work.
So, Dina, does the artist end up paying that by it being recoupable, or does the label eat that cost?
No, it's all recoupable. It's your money. Because here's what I say. The artist goes, well, why should I pay it? I say, well, I don't know. If you got a DWI and got arrested, you have to pay someone to get you to negotiate, you know, your deal. You have to pay a lawyer. You know what I mean? It's a business. So it's like, you know, there's no such thing as a free lawyer. Okay? The only difference is in the entertainment industry, because we're dealing with intellectual property rights, okay, much like real property rights, where lawyers, especially in New York, you don't have escrow, you build your fees right into the deal. Well, you end up paying for it when you buy or sell a house, depending if you're the buyer or the seller. It's the same thing with intellectual property. We build our fees right into the deal, and the fees are discussed. Now, let me tell you this. Another thing is who the record company is. Man, I don't know without a shadow of a doubt who I have to deal with, who I have to work with. Jim, I love Jim. So if I'm doing a deal with Windup, I know it's going to be fun to talk to him. We have a great relationship. He's a hard ass, but you know, we get along really well. You know, and I know what to expect, so I know how it's going to be a good negotiation. But then there's another record company with another lawyer that I might be like, the guy is an arrogant asshole. You know what I mean? And if I have to work with him, I mean, I'm too old for this. I don't like my serenity robbed. So if I have to work with this guy, I'm going to get paid for it. Anyway.
Very good. Okay, so now we understand fee structure. So.
Does everybody get it? No?
So now where are we with this deal? So Lisa, are you outraged or are you
Concerned. I want to talk more about the touring side.
All right. Are we at some point going to get Lisa on the phone with Jay?
Yes.
He's pretty much the one who knows.
I rarely would talk to them. It wouldn't be appropriate
it would
for me
be,
to talk
okay.
to the manager
at this point.
Well.
All right. Fair enough.
So Lisa, what do I need to ask Jim about touring?
Well, I want to know how he's going to calculate his 10%.
Okay.
You know, I hear these talks about adjusted gross.
Okay.
What is adjusted gross? Is he taking it, you know, after the agent commission, business manager commission, lawyer commission, manager commission? Is that his adjusted gross?
Well, what if I go back to Jim and say that? What if I try to get him to commission net? Like, what if I get him to stand behind the manager's commission, 15%, lawyer 5%, business manager 5%, agent 10%. Let's make him stand behind those commissions, you know, and stand behind a tour budget that he can approve, you know, in each instance. We'll be transparent with our costs. You know, your girls don't have hair and makeup of $6,000 a month. This ain't TLC, so you know. So what we'll do is, you know, let me go back and ask him. Hey Jim, Lisa wants to know because the girls do touring and the management company is really involved in this. Can you explain to us how you're going to commission? And it says here gross receipts. But you and I talked about net. So.
Well, what I talked about was adjusted gross.
Yeah.
So what I would allow for is I recognize that the agent can typically get 10 right out of off the bat. So what I would do is I would calculate my 10 off of effectively 90. So my 10 is really 9.
Okay, so in other words, if there's $10,000 coming in, you're going to get, you know, 10% of $9,000. But after, so you're going to get paid, and then after that, there's 80% left, or 8,000 left, and the manager has to commission that, and everybody else has to commission that. Right? So
well,
why
the way I understand it is managers, business agents, usually want to get calculated on the same basic number, that 90% number. So
yes.
What we wanted, pardon?
We generally, we're generally gross less any sound and lights.
Right.
So
so you don't stand behind the agent?
No.
Good
job. Yeah, because there's a lot of work to be done. We
well,
do
I recognize that.
Yeah. I mean, so we all kind of.
I'd be willing to also have sound and light come out, but what's key to me, because I'm getting paid on, now there are costs that are coming out before my percentage is calculated, costs which I don't control. I need to know that those costs have got to be reasonable and customary, not be excessive, because I can't find myself in a position where my adjusted gross is zero. Unless, of course, you're in a situation, I recognize there'll be situations where the band's going to tour in the red, where they're going to tour with a very small margin. And again, I'm not looking to put this band upside down financially because of my passive participation. So I would be willing to build in some protections that, let's say, the show doesn't gross more than $1,000, I won't participate in those shows. Or let's say if you take my 10% of adjusted gross off the top, I'll stop at zero. As long as their costs are reasonable and customary, I won't take any more than what's their break-even.
Well, Jim, why don't we do this? Why don't, for each tour, okay, you look at the tour budget. You know, if you're going to be in bed with us on this, then you have to, you know, be involved in this. So you see what's going on. You could look at the tour budget, but, you know, the thing is the business professionals have to get paid if they're putting together the tour budgets and they're routing the tours with the agents and they're trying to get the act on all these different tours and opening for people. So, I mean, there has to be money there for us to work. I mean, as much as I love you, Jim. I mean, your paycheck comes every 2 times a month. I mean, me, I got to hustle for my nickel. So it's like, you know, I want to make sure that there's money there that we're able to commission and work. And I understand that you'll stand behind the agent. I appreciate that. But, you know, I think that you should stand behind, if you could stand behind 30% and get paid on 70, I could try to sell this with Lisa. You know, because I don't know how that's going to work where you're end up getting paid better than we are and we're the ones getting the calls at 3 a.m. and having to do all that. I mean, I don't think this is going to fly with us.
I would say this, that we are very involved with the tour. We will have our promotion team, by the way, will be out on the road with the band, taking them to the local radio station during every day that they are on tour. They will go to a radio station before the event, before the concert. So that will be our people on the road with them on our dime, taking them in, making sure they meet and greet everybody they want to meet and greet. We'll do meet and greets before or after each show. We'll be handling that. Our merch person is good. We have a merch person at each venue. They'll be working closely with the band. So,
yeah, but still,
notionally, although only taking a small percentage of some adjusted number, it's not like we're not providing any services.
No, I understand, but you also are owning, you also have those income streams. So I'm sure you want to take them to radio stations. You own the master recordings. You need those radio stations to play your property. I'm sure you're going to have a merch person on the road. You have the merchandising rights. You should have a merch person on the road. I'm just saying, like...
The reality is, if my radio people don't get, especially in this genre, if my radio people are not successful at getting this record played on the radio, the touring opportunities are going to be few and far between. So...
I mean, I understand that, but I also understand it's going to be hard for me to sell this to my clients when the label is getting paid better on touring than the manager, their lawyer, and them. I mean, it's not going to be able to work. I could probably sell it to them, given the climate of where we are in the music industry, but you're going to have to stand behind the commissions. I just don't know how I'm going to be able to sell that.
Let's do this. Let's put a pin in this issue.
Okay.
I'll take under advisement your notion of us getting our percentage on effectively nothing less than 70% of gross. And let's see where we end up on the other issues.
Okay. Then maybe, unless you need to make a phone call to Lisa, maybe this would be a good time to take a break and become slightly intermittent. So we're going to take about a 10-minute break, folks. We'll be back here in exactly 10 minutes. And thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. This has been a NAREP presentation. NAREP is your record industry knowledge network. For more information and audio programs, please visit us online at www.narep.com.